Hello, listeners. Welcome to Human Rights Unscripted. Before we begin, I'm pleased to announce that the Human Rights Brief, Volume 27.1, has been published and is available now. This newest volume includes insightful articles about the prevention of torture, the repatriation of North Korean refugees, and a detailed analysis of the human rights violations inherent in female genital mutilation. It also provides a review of cases from the Inter-American Court of Human Rights and the European Court of Human Rights. As you can tell, this volume provides a very thoughtful look at some of the most important issues in international human rights law today. To read the volume free of charge, go to our Instagram page at WCL Human Rights Brief or visit our website, hrbrief.org. And now, on to our interview.
Hello, and welcome to Human Rights Unscripted, a podcast from the American University Washington College of Law, where we take a deep dive into the field of human rights through candid interviews with professionals, professors, and students. My name is Kathleen Burns.
And I am Jaya Mantovani.
Today we are joined by Shima Bazorgi. Shima is pursuing her SJD here at Washington College of Law, and she's currently working on her dissertation, reviewing the nexus of human and national security in the Middle East. After earning her law degree from the University of Tehran, Shima worked on children's rights and child labor issues. She has over 10 years of experience with government and non-government organizations. She is currently a coordinating and executive committees member and a vice president of the Phoenix Project of Iran, which is a nonprofit organization conducting interdisciplinary research into sociopolitical, economic, environmental, and technological aspects of Iran. So we're so happy to have you here.
Thank you so much, Caitlin and Jaya, for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
What exactly led you to the law?
That's actually a very interesting question because to give a little bit of background context, after the 1979 revolution, some of the academic fields such as law, human sciences, and economic and political science were marginalized. So about 20 years up until the 2000, law was a little bit marginalized and it was overlooked and a little bit oppressed. So a lot of female students in high schools wouldn't pursue it, or their families might not necessarily let them pursue it because they wanted to go to medical or engineering field. But I remember because I exchanged so much information about socioeconomic and political issue with my father, one day he dropped an article on my desk and I studied it, and it was the story of a female lawyer at the time, and this is early 90s and I was a teenager, that she was working on a chain murder case in Iran at the time. And so I jumped out of my room and said, I want to become a lawyer. And my parents looked at me, okay, we'll talk about that in a few years. So that was sort of the start point where I decided to go to law school. And up until the 2001 and 2002 that I got into University of Tehran, there were still a lot of naysayers that, it's going to be a difficult field, or it's going to be a lot of religious studies and you have to go to the best law school, it's hard to get in. But then I did it. I went to University of Tehran and I finished my law degree there.
That is an incredible story. What has been your experience as a lawyer in Iran advocating for, you know, the issues that you're passionate about, especially, like, I think it's important to also mention, like, as a woman, you know, in that field?
So I worked briefly after law school in Iran, and while I was at law school, I did two research papers, and obviously my field was child labor issues. The reason I was so interested in child labor and some of the problems women were challenged by, because we have a large number of child labor happening in Iran, is a big crisis in the country. And to give an example is that on every intersection of the streets, you will see a child under age of 13 and maybe up to maybe ages of 15, but sometimes 7, 8, 9 that are selling their flowers, chewing gums or something, and they're working basically. And the number is very large in many different provinces. So you don't see that in a lot of Western countries. You see it in a different way, maybe for homeless issues, but you don't see as much children working like that. So it was very upsetting. And that was the reason I wanted to work on that. And immediately after law school, I started working with a nonprofit that they're still working in Iran. And it was my first experience to sit on the ground. And we had advocacy issues, not just just for the children, but also their families, hygiene issues, education, providing services, other services for their families. Some of them were also non-Iranian children, immigrants from other countries who were there. So it was a very heartbreaking, but it was very fruitful. And I met not only a great group of advocates on the ground working on those sort of issues, but also came close to how law, policy, and politics all sort of connect with development, of course.
How did that compare then when you started studying law in, you know, America?
So if I want to talk about the differences between the law school in Iran and law school in the United States, I need to first address the difference between legal systems that U.S. is obviously a common law system. Iran's civil law system is a civil code system. So we have abundance of written laws. That people expect the laws to be implemented correctly, but it's not necessarily always the case. People might have the same criticism about the US, but the law schools are different also in the aspect that there are a lot of more debates happens in the US because the freedom of speech is protected under our constitution. The second aspect is the legal system that are different is that the Iranian legal system is very much embedded with the Sharia law system, especially more forcefully after the 1979 revolution. So you have the judges or people at the court that have to be in that jurisprudence or clergyman at the head of the courts. So women cannot be head of the courts or judge. Since the 2000 that I was at law school, it has changed a lot. We have a lot of more female lawyers, but we still do not have them in the judge seat. Another third maybe aspect that I like to see in the future Iran that I like in the U.S. legal system is the existence of Supreme Court. Maybe at this time, people have criticism about the current or future status of Supreme Court in the U.S. But I think still the reason that this institution exists there, it at least gives some avenue for people to seek their civil grievances. We have abundance of cases under the First Amendment for freedom of speech, for people rituals at schools. And that is something that really can protect people. Or if the lower courts doesn't respond, they will go to Supreme Court and then other courts have to follow. What we have in Iran as the highest court of revolution is not necessarily a Supreme Court. It is a court that basically addresses political prisoners issue, whatever the term political prisoner mean in the Iranian legal system. And so the absence of a Supreme Court, I think, is something that is missing there. The legal systems in general, main aspect is that the separation of church and state or religion from the government doesn't exist in Iran. And that is something that the common law system at least tries to have it and protect under the constitution at least.
I'm really happy you brought that up because it is a great segue into our next topic that we'd really love to talk to you about. And that is the intersection of law and religion and the freedom of expression. What has activism related to those issues historically looked like in Iran?
So activism, I think, in Iran, just maybe in general, started around the world in the 90s, 60s and 70s because of all the movements were happening in the world. You know, for example, at the time, we only had I had the opportunity to do internship in the United States with Amnesty International. And maybe in the 1960s, Amnesty was the only organization around the world that was doing advocacy work. But now, if I remember when we were doing advocacy work in San Francisco on AIDS Day, there were thousands of organizations that were doing advocacy. You know, we had a big fair in San Francisco and they were like all next to each other. So advocacy not only has changed outside of Iran, but in Iran, it was also started in maybe early 70s, maybe people getting more aware about it. And as much as the maybe previous regime, people want to criticize or they want to say it was wrong and that's why the revolution happened. But I still believe that the initiation of the issue of development started before 1979 and started in the 60s and 70s. But it was sort of stopped with 1979 revolution. And it came to the way that religion was priority for everything. When you bring that aspect to politics, to society, to legal issue, it will create a hurdle for a lot of development issues. So advocacy was stopped again, because right after revolution, we had 8 years war. So war was the only issue people were allowed to talk about or deal with. There was barely food enough for people. People were leaving the country because of the war. So there was no talk of development or advocacy until early 90s. And then 90s, because the government system is very much oppressive, So again, advocacy was marginalized and there was no internet at the time. All of it maybe started to change a little bit when internet found its way to Iran. So there was all of a sudden a connection with the outside world that we could reach out, we could send emails, we could see the websites, we could, everything change. And so there was a talk of civil groups that they came out after that, heavily chain murders of the political opposition in the 1990s. So a group of advocates came out at the time that started working on child issues. They started working on that chain murder issues, but then again, it was suppressed. So the advocacy in Iran basically goes up and down and up and down. And you have to be very careful of the sort of organization that you work. For example, they allow child labor organization, but again, they are sort of scrutinized that they don't do political activity. It's only advocacy, hygiene, maybe even education to some extent control. But if, for example, you want to establish a women's rights organization, which started in the 2000, but then they're all closed and shut down. It depends on what type of advocacy you're doing. It is not as lively that here we can have all sort of different organizations. It's easier to establish, it's easier to continue. Back home has to be very much in line with the government sets for you.
Has the government's desire to really exert its control over domestic politics affected advocacy groups, primarily in them finding themselves confronted directly with government demands to stop their practices or their programs? Or is it generally through funding? Is it hard to get funding for any type of activity that's not?
Nonprofits in general, they don't rely much on, just like in the US, they don't rely much on the government because it's called nonprofit and NGO. It is mostly the type of activity that they're doing that government has scrutiny over. And obviously the funding too, for example, somehow they find out that the funding is coming from certain countries that is not in line with them, or they have political issue with, is obviously goes under scrutiny, let alone that funding cannot easily come to Iran anyway because of a variety of economic restrictions that exist. So mostly the restrictions is about the type of activity you're doing. Certainly child labor organizations are a lot of them because of the huge and large number of children that are under this crisis. And then we have a lot of areas that are underdeveloped maybe or developing. On other provinces, not necessarily in the capitals and larger cities, that a lot of organizations start working on deprived areas, you know, that are dealing with a lack of water, poor climate, or not having access to enough food, proper education facilities. So a lot of organizations start working on these sort of issues, and some of them, one of them, which was actually had a pretty okay relation with the government, and it was shut down almost, I think, a year ago. So with no explanation, because they said, well, the explanation the government gave that they were working with foreign governments or foreign entities, which we don't know. There is never an evidence given. What they were doing was good work and what people need in the area. Organization, yes, can be shut down at any time. People are very careful to stay alive to at least be able to do something for deprived people or areas.
Was this something that for you working with the advocacy group that you did after graduating, how did you find yourself dealing with frustrations that you maybe had, even in your ability to direct what you wanted to do?
So again, for example, if you had certain events, as I said, some of the children we're working with, immigrants, children from other countries, for example, they didn't have identity papers. And still until this day, a lot of them don't have identity papers. And so it was hard to get in that, at least give them some permission to do certain jobs. It was hard to get connected with the UN offices in Iran. And even when UN office finally one day met with us, they sort of said that we have double restrictions in Iran as opposed to other countries we work, maybe Thailand or Vietnam or other countries. Because the government, because of the security that they are very concerned about, they're constantly having this security issues with the government, you know, that they're sort of just constantly want to control. So long as you are, your organization doesn't do political activity, definitely not allowed. Political expressions are not allowed. You're only allowed to do certain, as I mentioned, hygiene and very bare minimum development education. And with education, again, they sometimes might check on to see what is it exactly that they're teaching, which normally it was the book that was already taught at schools. And there was also another angle with the child labor working on the ground is that people sometimes, because the advocacy is hard to raise, because at the end, the child advocacy issue comes down to poor economy, poor development plans, and not having the correct policies, and not being able to reach out to the parliament easily. It came down to basically government and state. In the US, another difference you were talking about, the difference between Iran and the United States, that in the US, our economies run private sector a lot. We don't always rely on the government. Private sector and private companies helps out a lot. In Iran, the economy based on constitution is 80% government run. And so if you raise certain advocacy issue a lot, that comes down to, oops, you, the government, are not doing the right job, then that becomes a security issue for them. So you have to, again, be careful of to what extent you're going to advocate on that, for example, child labor issue. And then people, on the other hand, you need to create awareness in the society that this is a crisis. We need to look at this as a crisis. And then to raise that awareness, to reach out to society also is not sometimes easy, because people think, oh, well, it's never going to be resolved. So what you're doing is a temporary panacea to a very, you know, longer and deeper issue. But then again, if you don't do nothing, it's even worse. So
the percent of Iranians below the poverty line has increased from 20% in 2016 to between 30 to 35% in 2022. So when viewed along current high inflation rates and economic stagnation, what does this mean for women and children in Iran and the work of advocates there right now?
Yes. So obviously the cost of everything goes higher when the economy gets worse and worse. When the cost goes higher, then people who are private donors, such as, you know, individuals, such as families who can't do that, then they stop, they hold back a little bit and say, oops, I can't do this month, or I can't do this donation to this organization. So it affects the donors, and then smaller donors, because here in the US, for example, you get really large donation for certain organization. In Iran, that happens through private sector, but it's still, it's not, it might not be constant. It might not be the way we do it in the United States. So it affects the donors. It affects children and women are always the target, because we are talking about quality of life. And what do we want for our children? A better education, better school, have a quality time for parents, mother to be able to spend with the children. If mother has to work because economy is not doing well, then there is no that time to spend with the children. So they are all interconnected with each other. Yes, economy has gotten worse and worse in Iran, unfortunately. And that is despite being a rich country on natural resources and other basically product that they can export, but there are a variety of reasons why the economy is where it's at.
Now, I'd like to shift and talk about other ways that the government and maybe even the private sectors has impacted life in Iran. I'm sure we've all heard about this issue recently, but the Guidance Patrol, known also as the military police, established as a unit of Iran's police force to uphold Islamic morals and law on proper dress, were introduced, I believe, after the 1979 revolution.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Can you expand on exactly what is the power of the morality police, and what, if any, connection or impact has that had on the sector or women's rights?
So, as you said, it started in 1979. Before 1979 revolution, women would wear either, you know, they could wear anything they want, whether they cover themselves or not cover themselves. It was not any regulation on that. So 1979 revolution, the Iranian Islamic revolution had three pillars. One was be anti-West, in particular America. Second was to be anti, unfortunately, Jewish community, in particular, maybe Israel. And third was be anti-woman, because women freedom meant a security issue. So these three pillars started with 1979 revolution. And it wasn't that women just accepted that in 1979. There are videos right now with the access to internet that we see people were marching in the street until March 8, 1980s, 81. And it wasn't until they were forced, they were removed from offices if they wouldn't cover their hair and have a headscarf, or they wouldn't, they had to not wear, they were banned to wear skirts and other dresses. So the fight started right there. A lot of people realized very quickly after revolution that this was a mistake. This was not what we fought for, but there was no way back. And again, as I said, so heavily controlled during the 8 years of war. I remember there was the car that was also doing the patrolling. It was called Patrol. So, and a lot of people remember that. And so you would get arrested. That was in the 90s, was also the same thing. People were had to have their parties separate, women and men segregation as separate, university classes separate. So a lot of those pressure came down in every aspect of society. What changed again with late 90s and the early 2000s with the internet and everything, and especially nowadays, is it still continues. So the concept is there. It's just the scope difference with this military moral police or hijab police or this entity that exists. It was always there. It's just their duties and their mission and the pressure they put varies from administration to administration or from president to the other one, but it doesn't disappear. Obviously, with new generation every year, they want more freedom, they seek more freedom, they want to live liberated, they compare themselves with abroad, and they just don't want to accept these restrictions anymore. There is another sort of fight is happening. So it used to be women, because they were mothers, they wanted to protect their families. If the morality police or those patrolling cars would come pick on them, they would just be quiet. There was no cell phone. You could get arrested and disappear. But now that's not the case, because the cell phone captures it and camera captures it. Somebody else will filming it. And so it's not the case anymore. There is a constant fight. Women respond back. Sometimes they fight back. It used to be only men who were sort of the police and with some women on university campuses and offices. But now there's also women police that does this in the control, especially metro stations and places like that. Also, they just change, but they don't stop doing their activities.
In December of 2022, the Iranian Attorney General Mohammad Jafar Montazeri announced that the morality police would be suspended. Was that a change in the narrative?
So that was a headline news that came out in one of the speeches he was given. And then immediately one or two of the US Western media wrote about it, which was not true at all, because he's not the authority person necessarily to change that order. And what happened recently is that obviously a lot of things in Iran is run by the head of the government, which is the Supreme Court, Ali Khamenei. And he's the one decides who has to be in power, remove whom from the power. And he just recently removed one of the military persons and appointed Sardar Radan, who has a long, basically, record of social freedom and oppression that he prevents and restricts. They immediately came out and say that is not going to go away, Gashter Shad or patrol police is not going away. And they actually said that they're going to, because people in this during this protest have removed the cameras on the street and CCTV, they're going to go put them back, and they're going to remove women, something that they did in the early on revolution, that they are going to remove women who don't abide by the proper hijab. If they catch you on the cameras on the street, they are going to find them basically where you work. They're not going to go away. The entity has not been dismantled at all. If it's supposed to be basically ends, it has to be officially announced. It has to go proper channels. That is not the case what we see here. So that was one of the misinformation they played, and it was in the news in the West.
It seems that this movement has potentially involved women from different arrays of the social ladder, including maybe even the families of Revolutionary Guards, and that there's been potentially some hesitation in exerting control over urban areas versus rural, where maybe the government is more likely to be more violent. Do you think that this is a sign of fundamental fracturing in the government's hold, or even of military power? Or is this potentially just a continuation of what we've seen before?
Your question basically has two aspects to it. One is if the Revolutionary Guards are changing anyhow, or if rural versus urban. So one thing I'm going to flashback is that 2009, when the election 2009 happened, and people thought it was stolen, it was a rigged election, and the protests and the killing, security-wise, a government that was already very much concerned about security all the time. Security wise, they changed after 2009. They established more entities within their military and intelligence establishment, more control, more basically sectors within the sectors that they already had, and more control. All of it started 2009 because when people came to the streets, it was almost a million, according to some data in Tehran. That was a huge security issue, and a lot of people killed and tortured at the time, heavily suppressed. So they realized we need more control. What sparked and changed this one, because that one was a lot in Tehran was happening, bigger cities in a larger amount. Well, this one, the government sort of lose control for a couple of weeks, because one day Kurdistan will rise, and another day was Sistan Baluchistan, then it was Tehran, then and Sistan Baluchistan and Kurdistan are obviously on the border side, and you know, have a different economic and socio-political challenges they have compared to Tehran maybe. And so government was sort of actually confused because they lost control. So when they lose control, they start torture and killing in the prisons.
We talked earlier about the microscope of the international community, how they've kind of almost put Iran on the slide in the microscope at this point. And there was actually an open letter from global women leaders and advocates to the UN, the United Nations. And it called for an immediate end to state violence and the safe release of thousands of detained citizens from these protests. Is that a realistic request for the international community?
There was a data, which is part of my dissertation. There was a data about the trust with the UN system. And one of the lowest area that the trust was really low was Middle East. And compared to maybe Africa, compared to maybe other regions of the world. And within the Middle East, there were areas that were less optimistic about the UN and how they operate. But the mistrust about the UN maybe exists in other countries is because of just the way UN was established and the way it operates. What people in these countries, such as Iran, want during this revolution, during these movements, is that simple word of condemnation does not help us. Simple word of support will not help us. Action speaks louder. A government that is in its essence against women should not be on that commission. So why do the United Nations put Islamic Brotherhood on that commission? Well, on the other side, the UN thinks or assume that if they put this sort of states on these commissions or groups, there will be an incentive for them to change their behavior, where they haven't. The record shows us they haven't. So that was basically very late action. It was necessary to remove them, but it was already should have not happened in the first place. Now, am I happy or people get happy? I think the slightest message or the slightest, not just message, an action that affects the Iranian government, at least maybe embarrass them around global community, still is a good decision, but there is a lot of long way to go. It needs to have stronger actions and stronger messages on behalf of the international community.
A lot of the conversation from the Western perspective on potential recourses for action for international governments is centered around sanctions.
Yes.
And it seems that this is rather unproductive on the ground, and potentially actually makes the economic situation for the real life, day-to-day life of Iranians harder. Is there a conversation happening that you think productively recenters what the international community can and should do beyond simple words of condemnation, considering that their hesitancy to get involved in the political matters at all, especially after 1979?
Everybody knows and talks about that in DC, obviously, sanctions and nuclear program. I always look at it and say, why a country, whether Islamic Republic of Iran or any other country, should be sanctioned? Why are they under sanctions? And I look at sanctions on the second point is that I look at them as a probation. We say, people, you have done a crime. You're going to be under probation. Behave well. Don't do drugs. Don't do stealing anything so you don't have to go back to prison. I don't want to cut you again and come to see you in prison. But normally, a lot of times, we see the data shows that people who are on probation, they violate that probation. So why the Iranian government was put under sanctions in the first place? First, they violated the international law when they attacked the U.S. embassy in 1979 and captured a lot of U.S. diplomats. That was a bad act. That was a bad move. They violated that. So everything started from there. And since then, the Iranian government never tried to sort of change that. Then they got involved in outside of Iran in with the IRGC, expansion of IRGC. They outside of Iran, they did military activities in Lebanon. Then we had the explosion in Amia in Argentina, which was a Jewish center. So they did bad things around the world that put them more in sanction. Then they start to talk of, oh, Iran, Islamic Republic might access or gain access to nuclear power. Then they went on sanctions. So the question is why a government and a state that has to have prioritized their own people will do things that violate that relation between people and the state. I'm not saying sanctions hasn't impacted the economy in Iran, and I'm not saying that sanctions are necessarily a good thing. Sanction is like probation, is a bad thing. It's not something positive. It's not, the word is not positive. The impact is not positive. But what else we are going to do with a government that doesn't abide by any international law and international regulation? So UN Security Council has certain criteria where and when and to what extent we want to take action. We are not talking about military action. We don't want that. Iranian people have had 8 years of war. So, okay, there is no military action. We don't want that. Then we don't want to get involved politically because in the U.S., nobody wants to talk regime change because they're afraid, as you said, with the 1979 and everything that is behind it. And they think, oh, we don't want to get domestic involvement. Okay, so how do you want to get involved? U.S. doesn't have embassy in Iran. European countries have embassy in Iran, and they're acting very weak right now because just as we speak right now, there is a talk that EU needs to put IRGC on sanction list and consider it a terrorist organization. And they're not willing, their people in the EU that's saying no because they haven't violated. And I'm thinking in my head, all the documents, all the regulations, all the treaties that EU has about when and how a state or an entity within the state violates basic rights of their own people. The UN Charter talks about that. The United Nations document, they all talk about dignity of people, basic human rights, freedom of movement, providing for your own people. How else Iran and or entities related to Iranian governments are violating all of this? And how can you not put them on a terrorist list or a violent organization? So what are our options? Sanctions are, as I said, are temporary. Control is a temporary tool that the U.S. can use. And again, when 2017 and 2020, when the protests happened, one of the slogans Iranians had was that it is a lie that it's America, our enemies here. So they are under sanction. People know they're under sanction. They know their economy is bad. The prices are worse and above what is in the U.S., while their salary is way lower than here in the U.S. But they know if you release and remove the sanction on the Iranian government, the money will never come to them. It will go outside of Iran to certain groups in Syria. It will go to certain groups to Hezbollah in Lebanon. It will go to those groups. And or IRGC itself will just get richer and richer. And it will never help the Iranians on the ground. So it's a very complicated situation. Iranian people know that. They're suffering. They know they're suffering. But I think this is the end. This is the end that people are ready to give up their life for other people to stay alive. We saw it in the pictures that, you know, girls is sitting there and telling the security forces, come shoot me. I have nothing to lose anymore. Come shoot me. So that's where we are at. It's complicated, but personally, I believe the Iranian government has no way back. We have given them, I was one of the generation that voted for President Khatami in 2000. And he talked about reforms, freedom, you know, good words, pledges they gave. And at the end of his presidency, he came out and said, I was basically a middleman. He supported the supreme leader and he walked away. We have given them a lot of chances.
Overall, I think we've really just hit everything that I wanted to talk about, everything I was hoping that this would be. Like, you were just such a fascinating person to talk to about this issue. So thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely.